Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the program this week. My guest is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. You can call in your questions at 765-496-1999. Send an email to ask@wbaa.org. You can also tweet your questions to us at WBAA News on Twitter. Thanks for being here this week. I know we've kind of shuffled the schedule around a little bit, so hopefully people have gotten used to the flipped schedule, but we appreciate you accommodating us.
No, you totally ruined my routine. I'm off my game completely. No welcome jokes or anything like that, Stan. I'm going to play very nice today. Okay. No, I'm not.
So let's start with the biggest story this week, which is architects and developers inhabiting a vacant space in Chauncey Hill Mall, talking about what's going to replace it when it's torn down in a couple of years. Let's start with this. What sort of input is the city providing throughout this week-long process?
Well, we're providing a venue to actually get input. We learned a long time ago when we started doing some backfill, basically some building, and then we started doing a lot of the stuff with the State Street project, that even though, you know, from an engineering and a perception perspective, you know, we've got a pretty good grasp on what's going on, it's always best to get guidance from the people that you serve. And so we encouraged the developing company with the Chauncey Hill Mall project to go ahead and have sensing sessions to get some guidance on specifically what would be the best use in there. Now, obviously, that particular development's been kind of a, you know, when you talk about going to the top of the hill, that particular development's been there for a long time, and it's kind of iconic, even though its actual visual value has gone down significantly with history. The hope is that with the structures that are going to be put there, they will have uses that our community really thinks will be of value. But obviously, because of what it is, there will be limitations. We know that there's going to be a residential component. We know that there's the possibility of some sort of extended stay hotel going there as an option. We know that there is a possibility of having, there definitely will be green space. We've mandated that, so we want to make sure we could have some, maybe a pocket park in there. And then there'll also be some other commercial interests, like hopefully a grocery store or something to that effect. But the interesting thing is that when the developers are going through this, we just met with these guys yesterday. When they're actually going through these conversations with folks, you get two sides. The overwhelming majority is all positive. They love it. They love the idea of what's going to go there. They like the green space, the trees. They like what the potential is for some more retail options there and some different kind of things to do at the top of the hill. But the other thing is they like getting rid of what's there. And then the other side of it is you got folks that have memories. You know, they used to go to, drink beer there, or they used to get haircuts there, or they used to buy, different products there.
I have to say I was struck by the sort of nostalgia people seemed to exhibit at Monday night's meeting. People obviously have these memories of things they did in Chauncey Hill Mall when they were students, and they clearly like to remember those fondly. But, I mean, I just have to sort of be honest about the place. Whatever's going to go in there is going to be nicer than what's there now. And there was kind of that undertone to the conversation the other night. And you have to look at this thing as it is now. It doesn't look great. It's not quite an eyesore, but it's certainly not ever lived up to what people maybe thought it was going to be. Is it a place to go and drink? Sure, but that's about it.
It's not really pretty. They used to have a business in there. And when I was a little kid, I went there and got it. It was called Your Father's Mustache. And it was a place where you could go get a haircut. It was at that transitional period when they went from the spiraling, candy cane pole to having more of a welcoming environment and bringing it into, modern times. And this would have been in the 70s. And I'll never forget, back in those days, my dad was pretty strict about hair length. And actually, in his eyes, your hair would have been long. And just for the listeners out there, Stan has his hair really short. But my dad dropped me off to go get my hair cut there. And I walked in and it looked like your classic 70s vision. There were a lot of handlebar mustaches, a lot of long hair and everything. And I went in and they had me sit down in a chair and they kind of chuckled at me because they didn't think there was enough hair for me to get cut. So it's like, oh, man. So I said, just make it look nice for my dad, you know, and they went ahead and trimmed me up a little bit.
So there were some concerns at Monday night's opening meeting that if the mall is going to be torn down, and let's just put it right out there, it's toast. It's going to be torn down. That if people come back, especially alums, and they find a substantially different place, they might be less likely to come back and spend money here as often. Do you think that holds any weight?
Well, I think to people that hold those kind of sentimental views, sure. I mean, they might not be as inclined to come back, but I don't think that that's going to be a significant amount. I think one of the reasons why we're doing everything that we are doing, both in the city and on campus, is to bring people back, to bring a new sense of place. And, you know, I've lived here for ever plus 10, and there's a lot of things that I grew up with that are gone, and that doesn't change my opinion of our city. I still think it's the greatest place in the state of Indiana and really cool compared to a lot of cities in the country. And maybe I'm slightly biased, but I don't think that that's going to have that much of an impact. And oftentimes that sentiment allows for some great conversations.
The architect who gave that presentation, Neil Payton, tried to be pretty diplomatic in his response, but he said, look, that's a lot to hang on one shopping mall. What does the city need from whatever goes in there, starting probably a couple of years from now?
Well, right now, you know, my opinion is obviously an anchor, a really, really neat shop, national brand that people are very familiar with. But according to the sensing sessions, what we're hearing is that they just want sort of a continuation of that concept of a walkable downtown. They want to be able to shop. They would love to be able to get their groceries there. They would love to be able to have some form of entertainment there, whether it be a restaurant, bar combination, a movie theater, something to that effect. Because we recognize now with a lot of what's going on, not just on our campus, but on campuses nationwide, you know, the cars are becoming less of a factor. It's not significant. It's barely measurable. But the trend is that there's more bicycles and more pedestrians and more alternative means of transportation than vehicles. So the presumption is that whatever we have there will have a residential component and then multiple retail options just to bring more people up into the area.
One of the other concerns that was brought up was a concern about parking. It seems like there might need to be some sort of parking garage or something that's a part of this plan, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think they're looking at doing some underground work as well. I mean, there is, again, if everything pans out, you know, there's going to be much more pedestrian traffic there than there is going to be vehicular traffic. But to that end, we always make sure, because of our parking standards that we have within the city, that we go ahead and provide ample parking. So we will look to go underground as well as have some surface parking there.
Yeah, that seems like the most logical explanation.
Yeah, yeah.
Is to dig down once you've taken out everything that currently exists.
Yeah, but that's always a challenge. You never know what's going to be underneath there. You know, I mean,
You have maps of that sort of thing?
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be an arrowhead or something down there. If that's the case, all bets are off, you know?
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. You can call in your questions at 765-496-1999. You can go to email us at ask@WBAA.org, tweet at WBAA News on Twitter. I wanted to ask you about a piece of news that's kind of tangential to Purdue and thus tangential to you as well. Papa John's Pizza founder John Schnatter using a racial slur on a conference call in May. Forbes is reporting on this. He's now stepping away from his company entirely. He'd already been forced out as CEO when last year he made comments during the NFL season that players, many of them black, who were kneeling during the season to protest institutional racism was costing him and costing the company money. So here's how it affects this area. Even after the NFL comments, Purdue accepted $8 million from him to rename one of its centers on campus. The school says it's assessing what it should do. And so right now, the school, and by extension, your city, are associated with someone who is seen as making a racial slur. Mm-hmm. What do you think Purdue should do? Do you think they should rescind that naming rights deal and give Mr. Schnatter his money back?
Man, that's a tough one. You know, when you look at what we have going on, not just at this campus, but on any campus, campuses that have been around for centuries, they probably have a lot of people in their leadership history that have done a lot worse than that. But we live in a different world now, and there is a heightened sense of awareness of, at least there should be, of the sensitivities of others. And if there is a corporate leader, if there is an academic leader, if there is a political leader who seems to lack that necessary sensitivity towards others, that's a pretty significant issue, and it's a pretty significant issue to me. And you remember that I have done things, I had this other life before. And one of the interesting issues I had to deal with was a Klan rally in Lafayette. And the attitude of the folks that were there trying to bring their point of view across was pretty arrogant. It was an attitude of, you know, basically, if you can't handle what I'm saying, freedom of speech stands right by my side when I say this. And they absolutely didn't take into account the effect that it had on people.
In this case, though, we're talking about money being involved mm-hmm. here. Purdue took $8 million from Mr. Schnatter or his foundation or something like that. And so now you've got, you know, you're essentially paying mm-hmm. to have your mm-hmm. name on this center
sure.
that's affiliated.
You put your brand up there. You're buying.
Right. Affiliated with the Krannert School mm-hmm. of Management, which, of course, has its own reputation, as mm-hmm. does the university, as does the city. Mm-hmm. And does that mean that there's more risk to the university, to the school, to the city, because now you've taken money from this guy whose reputation has been in a steady downward trend?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that there would be. I would think that there would be, again, in this politically charged environment that we live in right now, with a lot of things coming from all angles, whether it be at the executive branch of our elected leadership or folks that have corporations that have been incredibly successful. I think that there's a certain level of accountability that people need to be held to. Now, again, the university is definitely in my city, but I don't run it. And I don't know what conditions the grant was given for. I don't know if it was an open grant or if it was specific. But my presumption would be that if the leadership of Purdue choose to deny the grant or to deny the funding, fair play to them. If they choose to accept it, then I think there needs to be some explanation as to how that money is going to be used and what the rationalization was for accepting that money.
On to other things. West Lafayette Representative Sally Segrist has recently blocked reporters on Twitter and made her account private after she launched an attack on her opponent in this year's race, Chris Campbell, who sits on your city's redevelopment commission. Mm-hmm. And so this actually came after Representative Segrist had liked a tweet, and she said it was an accident, that endorsed racist comments made by comedian Roseanne Barr after she was released from her television show. What do you think all of this says about Representative Segrist's campaign, do you think? Does this change the tenor of the race this year?
Well, I think it sure brings up an issue. I sure think that it does bring up something, again, sort of segueing from what we were talking about a minute ago. I know Sally. I like Sally. I think she's been very effective as a legislator. I know she's helped out our city fairly well with some pretty important issues. But I think that, and again, I'm not dodging, but I think generalizing, I think that this knee-jerk response to immediate nationwide or in some cases global access to people's attention is really getting people in trouble. You know, whatever her rationale was for, and I didn't see it. I'm not very good at Twitter. I'm wise enough to know that I should leave it alone. I do bad enough on this radio show. I don't need to have the privacy, do this in the privacy of my own home. But I think that there it does require an explanation. And I do think that there, you know, depending upon the content of her tweet, she needs to be given the opportunity to explain herself. More than just, oops, I'm sorry.
Well, it's somewhat a little bit harder if you're not engaging on social media, right?
Well, for me?
Well, no, it's harder for her to offer the explanation to a wide group of people if she's not engaging on the platform where these original comments were made.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that if there's, she should obviously take the appropriate action that whatever mechanism she used to get herself into this, she needs to use that to express her explanation as to why.
I think that's
one of the great big shortcomings that a lot of folks have with that anonymity of, you know, Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, there's a lot of courage when you're sitting by yourself. But I think if there is something where, you know, you send out something offensive or you miscommunicate your intent, I think that when asked, you should be equally as assertive and equally as responsive to explain yourself.
We talked about it on this program 2 years ago when you were a little bit hesitant to endorse either Representative Segrist or her opponent at the time, Vicky Wiesty, in that race 2 years ago. And only sort of late in the game did you officially endorse Representative Segrist. Does this do anything to whether you will issue an endorsement this time around?
Well, I don't think so, but I think that, and again, I'm apologizing in advance.
Let me start by asking, do you plan to issue an endorsement in this race?
Probably. I've not been asked, you know, and generally that's where this stuff comes from. You get asked for an endorsement and then you move forward. Sally and I are friends. Sally was with me at an event a few weeks ago. I don't even know when the tweet went out, so I didn't have anything to talk to her about in regards to that. But I know what kind of a person she is, and I know that, you know, it's shocking to hear that she has done something that could be so offensive. I know that that's not how she is. So I think before I make any kind of endorsement, I just want to sit down and talk to her and see where her head was at.
You said you would probably make an endorsement. You did not indicate just a moment ago whom you would endorse.
That's because you've trained me better than that, Stan. This will give us fodder for another radio show.
So, well, at least a fodder for this next question.
Quit foddering me, would you please?
To which side are you leaning if you think it is likely that you are going to endorse somebody? Is it the woman you endorsed 2 years ago or the woman who sits on your city's redevelopment commission?
Well, you know, I think that right now, just based upon the conversation that we have, I just want to talk to Sally and find out where she is. If she can respond, not just to me, but publicly, and give an acceptable response, yes, because Sally's got the experience. She knows the people down there. And like I said, for me, she's done, and for our city, she's done a very good job. I know Chris as well, and Chris has served very honorably on our redevelopment commission. But one of the greatest things and the worst things about politics is that oftentimes once you get that position, whether it be a mayor or an elected official at the legislative level, a lot of it starts with you getting to know people. And down there at the legislative area, the legislative branch in Indianapolis, being able to know who to go to get help when you need it is critically important. And even though, you know, only been there a few years, I think that she's already developed a lot of those relationships that have allowed for us to be able to get some things done when we needed her to assist us with that.
So I want to make sure that I'm accurately quoting you here. You're saying that for Representative Segrist to earn your endorsement again, you would want her to come out in a public fashion, perhaps even on Twitter itself, and explain how what has come to pass came to pass.
Well, I'd like to hear her explanation because, again, I'm busy doing what I'm doing here in West Lafayette. I have not, and I don't get on Twitter that much. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I'd like to talk to Sally about it and find out what's going on.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Our guest today is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. You can call in your questions at 765-496-1999. Email ask@wbaa.org. Tweet questions at WBAA News on Twitter. So I asked this last week of Mayor Rozworski, and I'll ask you now, too. Both of you are pretty committed to running for re-election next year. Mm-hmm. This latest incident with Representative Segrist, I think, seems to be part and parcel of a change, as far as I can tell, in the national political culture. It used to be I would have these conversations with mayors, and you would all say, you know, I'm so glad that we're able to rise above all of the vitriol of these campaigns.
Yeah.
It seems harder and harder to do that. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, and that's really an astute observation. It just seems like we've gotten weird and gotten mean, you know? It used to be that public service was an honor, and particularly if you were picked by people to be a public servant, that was an honor. Now, it's almost to the point where it's the winner of a brawl that, you know, gets the job. And I don't know if it's because of reality TV. I don't know if it's because of technology. I don't know what the hell it is. But it just seems like anymore, the only way to win a political race is to completely defeat and demoralize your opponent. And in preparation for, because I've sat through some of these prep things with other folks running for office, when they simulate a debate or something like that, it's nasty. I mean, they talk about stuff, man, that is intended to spike you to where you could have that vitriolic response, as you would say. And it really is not what you would look for in picking a candidate to represent you. You know, the cool thing about being mayor here is I represent a city. And I'm here. I live here. I work here. I play here. My family lives here. And so if somebody has an issue with what I've said or done, they can knock on my door, or they can catch me when I'm running, or catch me when I'm at the store, which they often do. But rarely do I have people come up to me that are absolutely insensitive or rude, or they are just completely just out of line. 9 times out of 10, it's usually somebody that just needs more information on something we've done or are doing.
Does this change at all the way that you will prepare for your campaign for next year?
No, not at all.
Let me ask, because you don't think that you're potentially going to get treated differently in this upcoming election cycle than you've been treated in previous ones?
No, I mean, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit there. I mean, look at what we've done. I mean, we've done a lot of stuff. And there are people that might not agree with what we've done. They might not like the projects that we've done. They might not like some of the companies that we've worked with. They might not like me, that, you know. And truly, when we talk about candidate versus candidate, becoming a little bit more aggressive in how they approach the election process, the citizens are too. I remember way back in the old days on the police department, we would periodically have press conferences when we would have big bad stuff happening. And the questions and answers were pretty softball. You know, it was pretty much what's going on, why is it going on, what happened here, et cetera, et cetera. Anymore, the questions are a lot different than that now. And then when you're dealing in a public forum, the questions are much more pointed. And they usually throw up a hypothetical or a belief that they have about some act or action that you've been involved in, and then demand an explanation as to why. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. I mean, we do need to be held accountable for the stuff that we're doing. But it's just that transition from how things used to be. I mean, think about how it was, you know, in the 50s and 60s when people were running for office. I mean, my God, you know, they scripted everything, you know. I mean, how could Nixon get away with what he did? And it just took to the very end before he finally got caught up into it. And, you know, can't even go where we're going, you know, with things these days. But so, I think we've just changed. Civility's a little bit tough, a little bit gone. And then because of the expectation of full reveal and kind of gotcha, I think that that's sort of changed some of the dialogue that we have nowadays.
Not that what I'm about to suggest is an uncivil act, because it is not. But
but see, you're easy.
I'm wondering, have you heard at all about whether you might get a primary challenger? Because I'll bet there are some people in the Republican Party who might not like the fact that your city has spent $120 million on this project in your last term in office. Do you have any sense of whether there is somebody who might run to the right of you?
No, I don't have any sense, but I would not be at all surprised. It's not even because of what we've done. It's because I'm not very political. You know, I don't run everything with a fist in the air saying, you know, Republicans, rah. I work for the city of West Lafayette. I work for the citizens that put me here 3 times now. And they are what drives me. There are some people that take my belief system and some of the things that I've talked about right on this show, and they think that I'm liberal. There's been tweets about how I should just sell out now and run as a Democrat. There's all kinds of different things. And yeah, I am very politically vulnerable, I think, within a conservative race.
Just a few more minutes with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis today on Ask the Mayor here on WBAA News. Remember, you can send questions for any of our 4 mayors at any time to ask@wbaa.org. I wanted to ask you about the county's new methadone clinic, which has opened up in Lafayette. It's designed to help wean people off of opioids like heroin, which is what methadone is used for. You have previously said you were against the county's needle exchange program, so I thought I would get your thoughts on the methadone clinic.
Well, I think that that's a good idea. I really do. I think that we're looking at the proper way to solve this problem. You know, the needle exchange program is sort of an after the fact. That's a mechanism for the addiction. But trying to get some help at the other side, the other end of it, I think is a value. It's almost like a proactive approach to it. And in other communities, both large and small, the methadone clinics have worked. Now, I know there's a presumption, once again, that if you provide this service, that everybody from a multi-county area is going to come here. They're not all going to be able to get service. They're going to set up residency here and bring issues that aren't necessarily positive for community growth.
I'll point out that there have been people who have made that exact argument about the needle exchange.
I know. I think I was probably one of them.
And so what do you think about that argument?
Well, I think, again, we're talking one is about providing a system for use. The other is about treatment. And I've always been a big supporter of going on the beginning, getting the early end to try and get treatment to folks who are sick. And the needle exchange program doesn't necessarily have that comprehensive service, but the methadone clinics, at least in my level of awareness of them, do.
I don't mean to interrupt, but let me ask about that, because you just said you want to get in on kind of on the ground floor. Mm-hmm. You want to get in early. Mm-hmm. Is it not making a jump to say, if you're already addicted to heroin, we're going to get you into the methadone clinic? Isn't the step before that, look, we understand you're addicted. We understand you are still using the needles. Mm-hmm. Is that not an earlier, more ground floor step to help people out with, based on the logic you just used?
Not necessarily, because the whole purpose behind the needle exchange program is to prevent the spread of disease. What we're talking about here is the addictive quality of the opioids, the almost immediate addictive quality or component of opioids. And the methadone clinics are in a prime position to assist with that. They've got counselors, they've got doctors, they've got facilities. And they're, again, using history for what value it can provide to us, that actually provides a process to where these folks can get off the junk. Heroin is just a nasty substance, and it creates even the intoxicating effects of heroin are not exactly what people think. I don't know if you're old enough. Do you remember the series Dragnet?
Sure.
Did you watch the old ones when they were in the 60s and 70s?
Absolutely.
I mean, Joe Friday's just hilarious. But
we strive for a just the facts, ma'am approach on this show.
Well, not even that, but the way that they depicted drug use and abuse, you know, the way that they personified the hippie culture and how that was, and then one shot of heroin and all of a sudden you're a homicidal maniac. Things are a little different than that. There are people that use opioids every day that are functioning at a fairly high level. It's treatable. It is treatable, but you have to get people in the right structure in order to be able to do that. And to me, that's where we start getting some of these drug issues taken care of.
Let me ask you another question in just our last minute here. Are you drawing a distinction between people who are recreational drug users and people who have become addicted to painkillers because of some sort of physical malady that they're trying to treat? Are you saying that you're more inclined to have the latter get treatment than the former through a needle exchange?
No, not at all. I think everybody needs to be able to have those opportunities and have it in a source where they're not going to be labeled. Because if you don't have anywhere to go, then you go nowhere. And with the horrific addictive level of some of these drugs, the opioids specifically, it's a lot easier to basically suffer in silence than to get help when there's no help being provided.
Last question. Are you more okay with the way that opioid addiction is being treated now that you have a methadone clinic, a needle exchange, and even a mobile exchange in some cases?
I think we're heading in the right direction. I think that we're getting close to that comprehensive level of where you can basically go, you know, at a full frontal assault to make sure that we can get this disease, get the addiction, and get the drugs taken off the street.
All right, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. That's all the time we've got for the program today. Remember, you can tune in at this time next week for our conversation with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes. And send your questions via email in advance. ask@wbaa.org is the address. You can find all of these shows archived at our website, wbaa.org. Just look at the Ask the Mayor page, and you can podcast this on the WBAA app as well. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.